KFMU DJ Eli Campbell here. One thing that makes Steamboat special is how many awe-inspiring people call our valley home. You could find yourself in line at the coffee shop next to an Olympian or sitting on the gondola next to the founder of a world-renowned business. Our community produces and attracts the best of the best in their respective fields, but most are so humble about it, you would never know. These extraordinary people are the common folk in the boat. Welcome to Common Folk in the Boat, our continuing series of interviewing the influential people of Steamboat Springs, some of which are entrepreneurs and business owners. Some are just the personalities that are larger than life, and today's guest is going to be one of those. We are going to be talking to Cookie Lockhart, longtime local Hall of Fame auctioneer. Really excited to have that conversation. But first, from one person who's larger than life to another. Maybe
that might be a stretch.
This is Dave Whitlinger of Billow Premium Cannabis. You describe yourself as the Ed McMahon to my Johnny Carson. McMahon was larger than life personality.
He was a close second to Johnny. Give you that.
He was larger than life, but not larger than Johnny. Let's be honest. And I think that's kind of our relationship here.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Of course, Billow Premium Cannabis, our great sponsor here for Common Folk in the Boat. We like to start every interview with what is Billow high on this week? So what are you positive about?
First and foremost, I'm very high on the fact that we're going to be talking with Cookie Lockhart. This is one of those that I've been looking forward to. It's been like big, you know, green X, if you will, on my calendar. So yeah. I'm excited for Cookie. The other bit of news, Eli, since you asked, very high on and very excited to announce that we are going to, it's pretty much official, although we haven't done any promotion for yet, but we are bringing back what we call the Cultivated Cuisine Dining Series this summer. So if you didn't already know, this is a 7-course fine dining experience at a local farm that's paired with cannabis the same way that you might have a wine pairing. But we've done these in the past. We have learned a lot. We've modified. We've made it. Hopefully this summer it's even going to be higher end and just a better experience. And I'm just thrilled about that.
Which is, I mean, it's a unique niche. You know, you've definitely have the food and wine pairing type of dinners. For a lot of people, you might not think about cannabis pairings with a dinner or a meal, but it's something that you guys have gotten into last year. It's exciting that you're bringing it back. And how did that idea even come about?
Well, I mean, obviously in our industry, one of the challenges is, okay, we can talk about the product, we can help promote the product, but at the end of the day, how do we get people using the product? And so if we can introduce, and there's also, I'll be honest, there's a legitimacy to this whole thing. I mean, I'm a firm believer, obviously I work in the industry, that this industry should not be as taboo as some make it out to be. So this idea of pairing cannabis with food seems to me like a natural fit. It's just now wading through the legalities of it, making sure that everything's above board. But at the end of the day, we know we're not alone in thinking that, yes, cannabis and dining, hello. Naturally.
It makes sense. As I think on a previous episode, we talked about, you don't need the study to understand the food component. Well, of course, if you want to get more information and find out when the information is released about these experiences, you can go to mybillow.com and sign up for the email blast. We want to, you said it, you know, this is a very exciting episode for us. You've never met Cookie. I've had a long experience with Cookie before, and she is a personality that she makes me smile. She makes me laugh every time I get to talk to her, and we have the opportunity here today. So we're going to bring Cookie Lockhart to the couch. Welcome, Cookie Lockhart. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Eli, now that I'm seeing you again. I haven't seen you in a long time.
It's been a while. I've talked on this podcast before how Dave is the first person to hire me to a professional job here in Steamboat at the radio station. But my first employer in Steamboat was one Miss Cookie Lockhart.
Well,
way back when I helped manage the tubing operation.
25 and 30 years ago, we rented tubes and I had the in place out because I owned that little pasture right where it's now part of Rotary Park.
Yeah.
You know where I mean? And so it was perfect because we could put them in out there and then they got off at Lockhart Auction original place at 11th and Yampa. And that's where you were.
Yep, that's where I was. People always ask me what my favorite job was. And without hesitation, hands down, I say I got paid when I was 16 years old to sit on the side of a river on a sunny day and tell people where to get out for their tubing. And it was, I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
Where does that job exist now? Because I would give it all up to have that job today.
It was, I peaked at 16 years did. Old is what it comes down to.
Sometimes you had to help people get in out of the river. So he would go out there and the river was deep, you know. And I tell them, we'd tell them how to, when they got in, watch for the guys in the red shirts, because he'd be waving at them, telling them that's where to get off.
It's funny. And most of the old, you know, overweight gentlemen, they kept floating. But the ladies in the bikinis, I'm sure, had all the help they needed getting out. Right, Eli?
You know, mostly because the least resistance to try to get. That's the only reason. Sure.
Yeah. Go with that.
Yeah. Well, of course, long before you owned a tubing company and an antique store down here, you were just a young girl growing up in Steamboat Springs a few decades ago. I just want to know, you know, from someone that's been here for so long and has had family roots here for so long, what was it like growing up in Steamboat before it was really the ski resort town that it is now?
Well, it wasn't like it is now. We rented saddle horses to tourists, and right there at that same place, 11th and Yampa, we had hitch racks and corrals and place to put hay, and we'd brought the horses in from the ranch every day, and then we rented to tourists. We also, one of the biggest customers we had was during that time, and we're talking in the 40s, 40s and probably early 50s, that there was a group stationed here, and I forget what they're called. People have corrected me, and the museum has it, but I thought it was the Signal Corps group is what I was told, and it was I thought it was a bunch of old guys, but they were probably young kids. At the time, they were stationed here because where we were fighting in France, the mountains were very similar to what they are here, and that's why they were here training. So they were a big part of our business of renting horses from us. Oh, before I was five, though, I was teaching tourists how to ride in these mountains. Oh, I was always horseback.
Yeah, I saw somewhere that when you, as early as 5 years old, you were talked of as in the paper as the princess of Steamboat. You ruled the town as a 5 year old, right?
That there was an article in the Pilot front page said everybody loves. No, not everybody loves Cookie. Everybody knows Cookie. They still don't love Cookie. Not everybody. In fact, I have that little article. I should have sent it to you because it's really a hoot.
Yeah.
It says you'll be driving down Lincoln Avenue someday or evening, and suddenly a pint-sized rider will dodge out between cars. You grab your brakes, kill your engine, and that'll be Cookie on the wharf. And it said, I went on to say I was starting a school that year. So I was only about five or going on six. And some tourist ladies, then to end it really funny, tourist ladies was walking on the street, and they stopped and asked me how long I'd been riding. And I took offense to that, I guess. And I said, about 30 years, and rode off.
As a five-year-old.
Five-year-old. I love that.
A little bit cocky. Don't you like?
A little bit cocky. Maybe you're just an old soul, you know? But so, you know, you're here in a time where there's no ski resort. There's still skiing. You know, the area is starting to produce its first Olympians. But it's really a ranching community back then.
Ranching and miners, mining. You know? Yeah, and everybody knew everybody in town, and everybody took care of each other. And, you know, you just, everybody makes a living because everybody needs something when it's a little town like that. I think it was 1,800 people. That's what I always remembered. I don't know if that was at what stage of my growing up it was, but that number always stuck in my mind.
And so as we've kind of obviously progressed into this ski resort town, there's still a ranching community here, but Steamboat is really world renowned for its skiing now. What do you see in the community as it is now that still kind of reminds you of the Steamboat that you grew up in? Not much. There's a big
pause. Which is probably the first time.
Yeah, I just made Cookie Lockhart speechless.
There isn't too much. You know, there's just a few of the ranchers. I think of more the Hayden area and Yampa. It just isn't the same.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about on this podcast a little bit before, though. It's still a community where people like to help other people, you know, whether it's it's a different, maybe it's not the ranching community as much, but entrepreneurs, there's still a sense of community here. It's what attracted me to Steamboat to begin with, was it's not just a ski town. It's got a community sense to it, which I think does go back to the many generations that came before us that are currently here. What would you say?
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
I probably am not as involved as you are. You know, I'm gone a lot. I'm here and there. And but it's always home. I say it'll always be home. If I may come back in a box or from wherever I am, but it's still home. Well, my cemetery lot's paid for. You know, I got to come back.
You have so to good. Come back.
You're covered.
Yeah, I'll be covered.
And I like that. You know, it's always home to you. And what is amazing to me is you are still traveling quite a bit because you're so well known outside of the Steamboat community for being a world-class auctioneer. But when you started in that, it was certainly a male-dominated industry. You were the only female in your class of 126, mostly men, all men, at auction school.
Men and boys, they were all males.
Yeah, and you were able to filter through and still persevere. Talk a little bit about how your mentality, what maybe you've learned in the Steamboat ranching community that you grew up in that helped you move through what was a male-dominated industry there.
Well, you know, Eli, my dad was an auctioneer. My dad came here in the 30s, sent from Fort Collins Bank, and they were repossessing equipment. And a lot of people were trying to make a living with 100 head of cows or so from, you know, from one end of the river to the other. And that was really impossible with a 59-day growing season. And people would start calving in February when it was 20. It was an impossible thing, but the main part that my dad saw was he was a real teamster. He had driven horses when he was a kid growing up. He was helping farm. And he knew a lot about horses and teams and harness. And the only way to feed at that time all these cattle were, you know, there wasn't anything motorized. So the only way to feed was with the team. So he raised Belgium horses because they were the most gentle. And he could show a rancher how they could load their hay sled and then wrap the reins. How to harness the horse was important. Not very many people know how to hitch up horses. My dad used to say, if somebody doesn't know how to hitch a team, don't bring them around here. And he always said, hired men. Anyway, they could, one man could put those reins around the rack and he could feed all by himself. And so that was really, I think my dad saw a real need here.
Yeah.
And that was how he came. He started coming in the 30s. And then in 41, he first rented the place at 11th and Yampa. And all the pictures of that place. Oh, my poor mother. And but he was great at everything. I mean, he was a master at so many things. Being a horseman, you wouldn't have thought he was, you know, he was a not only an auctioneer also, but he was really a great, like, carpenter, or he visionary in a lot of things that he could see how to do. He just totally remodeled the place, and he always had a hired man helping, and they were either shoeing horses or pounding nails or work, work, work. That was his four-letter word. If you weren't working, you weren't worth much in that era.
Yeah.
That might be bad to say today, but that's still how I grew up thinking. And then my brother went into business with my dad, and they bought and sold cattle and horses and real estate and auctions and, you know, whatever the community. My brother bring in a whole bunch of dolls and things for Christmas and have an auction because people couldn't get anywhere from here, you know. And so then my brother got sick, and he and I was really going to town. We'd have done great things together, but he was only in his 30s when he got sick, and he was 40 when he died. So the auction business meant so much to my dad. Auction, actually, there's as many kinds of auctioneers as there are doctors. And people don't, it's the most misunderstood business there is. People do not understand auctions. Yeah. It's because it's so varied. It's, you know, it's like saying heart surgery. What do we know about heart surgery, right? We don't know much, but there's so much to learn. There's just constant seminars and fundraisers and things that I'm always trying to keep up on. And it's a full-time job just going to seminars and staying up on things.
Well, and I think I mean, I was telling Dave, you know, I never knew, you know, you see that an auctioneer, you see, well, it's impressive that they can talk that fast and they can get people to bid more. But I never even knew that there was an auction school that you attended. And certainly you came out of, like we talked about, the only female. And then beyond that, you started to gain recognition, not just because you were a female, but because of how good you were at the job, to the point where you ended up on the game show To Tell the Truth back in the 1960s. And I've always been curious. I've seen the YouTube video of it. It's amazing. But I'm curious, how does a game show, I'm guessing based out of Los Angeles or some big city like that, New York, how do the producers for that game show find Cookie Lockhart in Northwest Colorado?
I was selling a livestock sale in Elizabeth, Colorado, and they had a machinery auction, and I sold it here. And from that, a guy asked me to come to Iowa, and he featured me in the opening of a machinery company there. But as during that time, so we're talking 66, we were, and my brother and I worked this auction, and we liquidated kind of a high-end interior design company in Cherry Creek. And it was a big crowd and a well-known company at the time. It's called Co Interiors, I just remembered. And from that, we got several other auctions. But they had a full-page ad in the Denver Post. I don't know what they had called it. Cost today, but they had pictured me as the world's leading lady auctioneer, or the first, or however they said it. I always suspected that they probably had scouts from different TV shows, and somebody picked up on that, and I just got a call from New York and asked me if I'd like to be on the show. And of course, I've never been to New York. I've never been, at that point, I don't think I'd been out of Colorado.
I'm sure we could talk for another hour just about your first recollection of New York City coming out of Steamboat Springs.
And what I remember is they put me in this tiny hotel room, about, you know, about 8x8. And I thought, this is New York. And so I wanted to go shopping. And now I forget the big department store, but one of those fancy stores. And so I went down the street and went into this store. And a guy was right in front of me and slammed the door in my face. And I went, whoa, that doesn't happen in Steamboat.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's a whole culture different shock. World. Yeah.
And so that show is on To Tell the Truth is on YouTube.
Yeah, it's incredible YouTube. And it's funny because you know, one of the things that interests me about why you or how they found you is we live in a world that's not nearly grew up in a world that's not nearly as connected as now. So it's not like someone can discover you on social media back then or anything right. like that.
And I'm just guessing that that's how it happened.
And now here we are in a whole new generation where the show from the 1960s is on social media. It's on YouTube and people are rediscovering you. Are you finding a younger generation of people that are recognizing you and finding you from just, you know, the different social networks and things that are being shared out there about the work that you're still doing to this day?
Yeah, I was given a seminar at an auction school a while back. And by the way, there are numerous auction schools, probably six I can think of off the top of my head that are all good. My great nephew just went to Bozeman, Montana. He just sent me a picture yesterday driving back in a blizzard through Montana. He said he couldn't believe how much he learned. It's a short school and it's like going to kindergarten. But anyway, I was given a seminar at the Worldwide Auction School. And there were some teenagers and they're young guys, early 20s, and they were nudging each other and they had their cell phones and they had pulled that up on YouTube. So here I was up on the stage supposed to be. They were laughing because they were getting such a kick out of it, of course. So I didn't even know until that time. That was been a few years ago. I didn't know you could go on YouTube and see it.
You're the queen of auctioneering. You're in. I said I didn't know that there was an auctioneering school. I also didn't know until I met you that there was an auctioneering hall of fame. And so, and I mean, it is an industry that I think you mentioned. It's not very well understood by us as outsiders, but there is a hall of fame. You are a very well respected auctioneer. And again, not just because you were the first female, you're the first female in the hall of fame, but the work that you do. What does it mean to be recognized by your peers like that?
Well, it's pretty cool. You know, I sent you that on what happened just this weekend, a couple of days ago, Saturday night. And they honored me because I actually went to auction school 60 years ago, almost 61. And I'm still selling, so they couldn't believe it.
60 years ago is a good life for a lot of people. You're still doing the business.
I hear all the time that I'm a trailblazer, and thanks for leading the way for women. There's quite a few women auctioneers. Yeah. There's quite a few that are selling at auto auctions.
And they're still having to compete with you because in a couple of weeks, you're heading off to lead another auction, right?
Yeah, that's just a fundraiser.
Yeah.
I never did sell at a car auction because I never thought they'd hire a woman. Now there's several women selling auctions. But the car auctioneers are something else. You know, that's just for dealers only I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So you'd mentioned there's as many auctioneers as there are doctors. Yeah. And I'm guessing that's an indication that there's different types of auctions. Help educate me. Does it make – like, are you specialized in a certain – do you have to know the products you're auctioning, or is it more the showmanship of auctioning? It doesn't matter what you're auctioning. Like, do you have to have an intimate knowledge of the products that you're liquidating?
Good question, David. The I would say the largest percentage of successful auctioneers specialize in something. If you think about that in the way of a doctor, they specialize in eyes, ears, nose, and throat, or feet, or babies, or whatever. And I never did, and probably because this is where I came from. There wasn't, you know, there has to be industry, there has to be population, there has to be, you have to have something to sell, and you have to have someone to sell it to. But if you stop and think about it, every commodity, the price is established every day by an auction. The stock market, the price of gold, the price of steers, the price of beef, hogs, whatever.
Oranges.
You don't think about that, right?
Right.
And if you think about it, also, a lot of people, it has a bad stigma in some areas. They don't realize if an auction is properly conducted, properly promoted, it takes a while to do it. But you're going to have everyone bidding against each other, and it will bring every bit as much money and usually more. I just sold a property at Yampa that I think brought more. It's just been sitting there for years. But, you know, the things like art and many other things, they simply, if they weren't sold at auction, they would never be in the millions of dollars to establish that market. Right. And I mean, the only way it's done is at auction.
Right.
But yes, most auctioneers are specialists.
I was going to say, like, so you've got, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Sotheby's is the big art auctioneer house out of New York, right? Yeah. Now, if you were to step into a high-end art world, would you say you'd be as effective as an auctioneer as, say, selling cattle and farm equipment? I mean, just to make an analogy there.
Well, those auctioneers do not have like a chance. And now that you ask, I went on an auction study tour to England many years ago. And they took us in the back room, and whether it was Sotheby's, it actually was another one at that time that's no longer, but they were equal to Sotheby's. And they showed us how they spend months and months getting ready for, say, an art auction or a book auction. The person that's a specialist in that, that is studying it for months, getting it ready, is the auctioneer.
Yeah.
And that's the only time that they are an auctioneer. But of course, people, like Eli said, what they really, the public sees is fast talking. That's the first thing they always ask me. Oh, you mean you can talk that fast? Blah, 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 blah. I go, yeah, but I don't think I sound like that.
That's how I would sound.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It takes lots and lots and lots and lots of practice.
Is that what you study at school?
When you first start.
Vocal training? Or is that just something you have to develop?
They have, in auction school, they have them, you count from 2.5 to 100 forward and backward 5 million times. Yeah. And you learn jingles like Betty Botter. Do you know about Betty Botter?
No, tell me. Well,
that's the things they do in auction school during that part of the training.
Okay.
But Betty bought her bit of butter, but she said this butter's bitter. If I put it in my batter, it'll make my batter bitter. So she bought a bit of better butter, put it in her bitter batter, made it her bitter batter better. No, it's a good thing. Better butter bought a bit of better butter, don't you think?
That's my new warm up for every time I
sold.
Go on the air.
Sold.
Every auctioneer in the world knows Betty Botter.
I'll bet.
Just ask any auctioneer and they know what Betty Botter means. Yeah. But they teach all kinds of things. They have real estate, guns, antiques, you know, you name it. There's seven. They've got specialists come in and teach those classes.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I've been to an auction before where I was just amazed at watching the auctioneer and just the different techniques. It was more than just fast talking, but the different techniques that he was using to up the bids and get more money for the product or for the fundraiser. It is a real, true art. There's comedy involved. There's storytelling involved. You have to be a unique personality to really succeed at it. What do you think it is about your personality that has helped you succeed so well?
Well, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you are one of the most unique people I know, Cookie. I've known you for 25 years. Your style is unique. Everything about you is unique, but there's a lot of people that have a unique style that couldn't be an auctioneer. You know, you're a people person. You're outgoing. I could go on and on, but I want to know from you.
Well, I don't know how to answer that.
I'll answer for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Here's the thing about you, Cookie. We just met. I don't know you that well, but I've known of you for many, many years. And the reason is, especially here in Steamboat, you have a personality that is larger than this room, than this town. I don't even have to have had met you. You could be at a Rotary luncheon across the room, and I would know that's Cookie Lockhart from your personality.
Yeah.
And I will say that about you. Again, somebody who's just now officially meeting you for the first time, you've got a personality that speaks volumes louder than even your own speaking voice. Let's say that.
I would have to agree. There's a few people in Steamboat that if you've never met them before and they walk into a room, you've heard the name before and you know instantly that's Cookie Lockhart. That's Billy Kidd. Like there's only a handful of them that have that larger than life personality in this community, and you're one of them.
So let me
Vern Lundquist is another one.
Yeah.
Let me put a quarter turn on that. So knowing that you've got the personality for this business, are you finding that that's helping you find success? I mean, back to the stories you've already told about people finding you through ads and putting you on game shows. Are you finding now, I mean, obviously you've been doing this long enough, but is your personality and your reputation is what's getting your phone to ring for these new gigs, for lack of a better word?
Reputation.
Yes.
Yeah. I think, I mean, you know, people do come to me no matter where I go. And I was on, what's the name of it? It comes up on the internet all the time now.
American Pickers?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I saw that, by the way.
Yeah.
Fantastic job.
I started calling it the wrong name.
Love that show.
Yeah. And they keep showing it. They keep showing the video. And it's been 8 years or 6 or 8 years. I think it's been 8 years probably. And they often show it. And somebody will call me in the middle of the afternoon or text me and say, hey, you're on right now. I'm watching it.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of fun with it. 2 weeks, they kept showing it. Just little snippets, you know, to get people to watch it on March 14th or whatever the date was. And a funny thing, I have a daughter in Alaska, and she had her back to a television and was at work, and she heard this snippet advertising for when I was going to be on that show. And she said, that's my mom. And she said, the people in that room went, oh, right. She said, no. It's my mom. She turned around.
She didn't even have to look at the TV. Right. She just knew.
Yeah. She felt like she was being reprimanded and you weren't even there. I remember when they came through town because it was the whole hush hush, like very.
Everybody was going, you know, up and down the alley.
You know, Sheik and Dagger kind of thing where it was, you know, because they were, you know, that show's popular and they don't want an audience. They want to get in, talk to Cookie, film the show and kind of meet under wraps. And then later, of course, make the big deal. But man, it was this whole like, I think they're in town. I don't know. What's Cookie up to? Let's figure it out. Yeah. So
I'm curious, Cookie, with all of the experience and history that you've had, what is the strangest thing that you've had to auction off?
In the first place, I don't use the word off. A lot of people say auction off, but I don't like auction off because off is a negative word. I like to think that we do the marketing and show it to the highest bidder. But
all right,
I've had some, not me. Well, if I told just one, it'd be funny. I don't know how to say it. A little embarrassing.
There has to have been something that you thought, man, this is so unique. I've never seen one of these before. Now I got to auction it off.
Not auction off.
Oh, so I've already blown it.
There, yeah. See, you're learning your lesson. Good job, Eli.
Man.
No, it was a donkey's thing you do.
A donkey thing.
And they made a cane out of it. And guys are holding it up and I'm selling. And over the microphone, I said, what is that? I thought it was some kind of wood. So that was.
It was.
That was a fun laugh. Everybody in the audience, I think, knew except me.
And how much did that go for?
What is the going rate for a donkey thingamadoo?
I'm just asking for a friend.
Nobody could stop laughing. And I'm like, what's funny about this?
It's unbelievable.
But there's been a lot of things like that. You know,
yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, my most unusual oxygen. You want to hear about that?
Yeah,
you have time?
Absolutely. Do you have the time? Yeah, we're on your time. We're on Cookie's time. Yeah.
Yeah. I sold a guest ranch. I was hired by a kid, 22 years old, and this has now been quite a while ago. And the ranch was Black Mountain Guest Ranch at McCoy. So right smack between Vail and Steamboat. And the owner and had been killed in a plane crash, and there wasn't any income, of course. So all of a sudden, this fabulous guest ranch had to be liquidated, and he called a couple different auction companies and ended up, I worked for a 22-year-old kid. And I could write a whole book about this one auction. This is the most unusual thing ever. These guys, well, let's put it this way. I was on a board and I was in a meeting 2 days before the auction, and somebody come in and sets the Denver Post in front of me, and the headline said, "Ranch dubbed as drug hub of the ski areas." And they said, "Don't you have an auction there?" And I said, "Yeah, day after tomorrow. You think I should call somebody?" I just panicked. My first thought was to call the DEA. Then I thought, they already know about it. But
it's on the paper.
That's right. Yeah, it's in the paper. Yeah. But it was a real blizzard, and the Denver radio station was saying not drive. You know, it's just horrible out there. And the Forest Service had to come in and help because the traffic was so horrendous. Trucks and pickups and trailers and holy Toledo. And I mean, we're talking horses, saddles, skis, snowmobiles, furniture, everything it takes to run a guest ranch is humongous. Oh, it was a 2-day sale, and it snowed something like 18 inches in between. But huge crowds, and a $150 saddle was bringing $400. I mean, it was just unbelievable. But what had happened was they were bringing, there were 7 people killed in this plane crash, and they were bringing the drugs in from wherever to Miami to Pink, and it showed that map. Right between Steamboat and Vail, it shows this map. And they had dropped the drugs off to this 22-year-old son, and they hit a mountain.
Was he putting them in the saddles? Is that why a $150 saddle is going for $400?
That was later. But, but what happened to the plane was they hit a mountain, and they were all killed.
And the plane was actively engaged in a drug run?
And what happened there was coming in from Miami, they were low on fuel, and the feds were chasing them. So they didn't dare stop in Denver. So they came on, circled that ranch, and dropped off the drugs to this kid, and then hit him up.
See, I think in my mind, you've just explained why a $150 saddle is not worth $400, because that story alone, like, I would love to own a piece of property that I knew was about to be seized by the DEA. Come on, that's fun.
Well, and I was a nervous wreck. I was, you remember Pat Mantle? Pat was there, an old time cowboy. Well, talk about a character. He had a personality deluxe. And, Pat was there as a good friend. And so I thought any minute they're going to come in and take all the money from this auction, because probably everything there was bought with drug money.
Yeah.
But I mean, there was cabins with original Western art in it. It was just unbelievable. And come to find out too, when it came out in the paper later, one of the top 10 most wanted men had been living there in one of the cabins. Well, I mean, this was just and you can imagine I was under a lot of pressure, and I thought any minute, and I had a motorhome and I had the cashier set up in the motorhome. So I said, "Pat, get over there and tell them to give you all the $100 bills they've got. Stick them in your boots or whatever." And so then we sent somebody else to do it because, you know, the kid hired me. I'm going to let the DEA figure it out themselves. I'm surprised they didn't stop me.
Yeah.
Because if somebody had been on the ball, they would have you know, taking all the money from that. They had a bus that they picked people up at Denver. And I mean, this was unheard of at the time, with a bus with a bathroom in the back and the kitchen where they served people that came into this guest ranch. And then this 22-year-old kid, he wanted to keep the bus, but he was scared to drive it from McCoy to Denver. And then he was gonna be okay on the freeway back to Florida, right? And so I drove the bus for him from McCoy to Denver. No problem for this kid. I learned to drive hauling cattle over those mountains.
Full-service auctioneer.
But that auction was one of the best. I remember turning to my dad and I said, "Do you want to sell?" And he said, "Nope." He said, "That boy right there is doing just fine." He was selling saddles. It didn't matter what it was, ski equipment, you know. I mean, there's a lot to run a guest ranch if you think of that.
Yeah.
You just start to liquidate. And I mean, just doing the inventory was unbelievable. Yeah. And today we would have thought we had to lot tag everything. We had to put it on the internet. And we didn't have to do any of that.
I can't imagine all the stories that you have from, you know, Steamboat when it was a little bit more rowdy and a little smaller town, to the auction life, to, I mean, you're still going at it too, as we mentioned. I mean, you're someone who has no plans to slow down. In fact, before we started talking here, you were talking to me about, well, maybe we can get a little business going. Maybe we can make some money. You have that mentality where I don't think you're ever going to slow down, are you?
Well, it slowed down quite a little. That COVID pneumonia tried to kill me, but I wouldn't let it.
Yeah, well, I can understand.
I still got things to do.
I'd be scared to try to kill you, too. So.
I get the.
You're going to retire. I'm sorry.
I get the impression you're too stubborn to die.
I don't know if it's stubborn. It's just, you know, what would I do? I never learned to play golf. I don't ski where the dog. Yeah, right. I don't do all those things that the kids do.
Yeah, but you can auction and you can do it really well. I want to thank you for taking some time to sit with us this morning. It's been absolutely incredible to reconnect with you and just hear some of these stories. And like I said, I'm sure that you could go on and on for days. This is just the tip of the iceberg for you, but you are one of the true common folk of the boat from the time you were the, you know, 5 year old. Everyone knows Cookie to now. Everyone knows when you're in a room. So thank you very much.
You bet.
Yeah.
Would you like to hear me auction?
I would love to end it that
okay.
way.
Okay. All right, there, boys. Step. What do you get for? I'm a 25. I'm going to get 30. What do you get 35? I'm going to get 40. David, 40. Now 5, 45, and 50.
I don't 50, even know what I'm buying, but yeah.
I'm get 55. Sold it right over there. David, the buyer, gets the money. Next lot.